This is the third in our series of at Microsoft conversations on privacy. We had one in last summer and one in the fall, and we hope to do more of them. This time we're doing this event in partnership with Berkeley, the University of California at Berkeley, and George Washington University, and we want to thank them for all of their help and coordination in this event. It's been really good. We're looking forward to a very interesting and sort of timely conversation this morning on the question of how best to address the challenges associated with personally identifiable information, PII, as Frank said. This is, you know, I think it's a particularly interesting and important topic, and it comes at an interesting time when governments around the world are grappling with this set of issues and how to deal with information privacy in the digital age. And Microsoft is very happy to have the opportunity to provide the forum this morning and to host this conversation. We'll begin the session today by inviting Professors Paul Schwartz and Daniel Solov from UC Berkeley and from George Washington University to present the paper, and then we'll follow with a panel discussion. In the paper, Professor Schwartz and Solov argue that while PII is one of the central concepts in information privacy regulation, it's not been well defined. And that presents a variety of challenges that's somewhat difficult in a number of circumstances. And they use their article to develop a concept of PII 2.0, which seeks to create flexible buckets of identified information, identifiable information, and non-identified information, or non-identified data. And their concept is to apply protections to each of these buckets based on the risk of the data in the bucket and the context in which that data exists. The panel, which will follow the discussion, will consist of Manisha Mithal from the Federal Trade Commission, Chris Calabrese from the ACLU, and Reid Freeman, who is an attorney at Morgan Forster. And we'll follow that panel discussion with a brief QA or a short QA from the audience, and hopefully it'll be quite fun. So with that, I'm going to turn the panel over to the professors, who will give us the overview of their paper, and we'll go from there. Oh, I wanted to say a few words of introduction about each of you. Sorry, I almost forgot that. So Paul Schwartz is a professor of law at the University of California, the Berkeley Law School, and a director of the Berkeley Center for Law and Technology. He's a leading international expert on informational privacy and information law. He's published widely on these topics. And in this country, his articles and essays have appeared in periodicals such as the Harvard Law Review, the Yale Law Journal, the Stanford Law Review, and the NYU Law Review. Daniel Solov is the John Marshall Harlan Research Professor of Law at the George Washington University Law School. He's also a senior policy advisor at Hogan Lovells. And additionally, he's the founder of Teach Privacy, a company that provides privacy and data security training programs to businesses, law schools, healthcare institutions, law firms, healthcare institutions, and schools and other organizations. Professor Schwartz and Solov have also collaborated on other projects, co-authoring the casebook Information Privacy Law and the Concise Guide Privacy Law Fundamentals, which they both published together last year. So with that, I'd like to turn the panel over, and thank you for joining us.
Welcome, everybody. It's great to see you. I thought that at a center devoted to innovation and technology, what would be better than to start off with an illustration of Dick Tracy and his two-way wrist radio? And this actually, I was just reading the comic book with Dick Tracy to my seven-year-old son, and it turns out the two-way wrist radio came up. It was invented by Chester Gould, the author of Dick Tracy, in 1946. And there we were in Berkeley. I was reading the comic book to my son, and it was really, really hard to explain why the two-way wrist radio was so cool. Because he's grown up with all kinds of different smartphones, and he finally doesn't realize that on the smartphone there's a clock. So he thought that the killer app of the two-way wrist radio was that you could actually have a clock and a smartphone and have it on your wrist. So if they ever want to bring that back, you can sell it to a seven-year-old in California. Now, what this has to do with our paper, however, is that what really one of the central points that we started from was the notion that the line between personal information and non-personal information was not fixed, but it depended on how technology changed. right? And so the technology of the two-way wrist radio, if you think about it, 1946, when I was reading about it in the late 60s in Queens, it seemed pretty cool even then, 20 years later. And then if you think how much change and innovation there's been in the last 5 years alone, the rate has changed. It's picked up so much. And so if you have this basic legal category of PII, non-PII, and the applicability of whether or not all of privacy law is going to apply is going to then depend on this very hard off and on switch. We realized in our paper that we had a big problem because you would either get maybe too much privacy law when the switch was on and maybe too little or no privacy law because you decided the switch was off and there was no personal information, but technology was going to change that, you were going to have a big problem in privacy law. Hence, we decided we had to take on head on this problem of what is PII. And now I'll turn the presentation over to my co-author.
So the first thing that we wanted to do when we looked at this problem was to first recognize just the importance of PII. PII is such a central concept in the law today. It's almost inescapable. It's the trigger for when a wide array of privacy laws and privacy regulation will apply to something. If it's personally identifiable information, that's when the law provides all sorts of regulations and protections. And when there isn't PII, basically, it's a pumpkin. It gets nothing. And so this is a very important, often dividing line between a lot of protection and no protection. And one of the big problems in the law is that even though it's so contingent and it's so important for the law, the law itself doesn't really have a good definition of what PII is. And so one of the things we started with is, well, how does the law go about trying to understand or define PII, which is its basic applicability? And what we saw was, in fact, that we looked at the various approaches in the law, and we came up with three categories, three types of approaches that the law applies. And we basically think all of them are pretty bad. So the first one is what we call the tautological approach, is when the law basically says that personally identifiable information is anything that identifies the individual. The problem with that approach is it's question begging. It basically says, well, PII is PII. But it doesn't really tell us, well, what does it mean to identify the individual, which is the key question. What is, in fact, identifying an individual, and to what degree is it identifying an individual? And that the test doesn't really answer the question. It just begs it. So as a result, the tautological approach is useless. So that then makes us look at other approaches. Another approach, which it's not even clear it was really even focused on PII, but it's often used, and that is the non-public approach, which is the idea, well, we'll try to regulate information that's non-public. This is the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act approach. But if it's public information, then you know all bets are off. The problem is that the line between public and non-public really has almost nothing to do with whether information is identifiable or not. And so as a result, I think that approach is deeply flawed because the issue that it's looking at really doesn't match very well to the issue of what's identifiable. Which brings us to the third approach, which is a very popular approach in the law, which is then to list and define specific types of PII. We call it the specific type approach, which is to say, well, PII consists of this and this and this and this. And a lot of data security breach laws and passed in the states use this approach, saying, well, PII includes a name or a first or last name, and then some kind of additional element like a social security number. It comes up with a list of these are the things that are PII, and these are the things that are not PII, and it just defines it. The problem with this approach is that, as Paul said, technology changes, things change, and the specific types today might not be work for tomorrow, or they might be badly drawn specific types that the legislature often, I think a lot of the data security breach laws are, you know, kind of already obsolete, the, you know, even before they were written, because their very approach is wrong in terms of what's identifiable and what's not. So I think the specific types approach fails in that trying to delineate specific types has not been very good in practice. What has been delineated in a lot of laws often is under-inclusive. And in addition, one of the challenges is the world of changing technology, which is a point that I'm going to turn to next. And it's the point that really complicates this entire debate and makes it a big challenge for how do we move forward on PII. So I want to talk a little bit about this problem, which is this problem of de-identification, and it really comes up in this context a lot. And that is that it's very difficult, and people experience great difficulty in de-identifying data, in trying to get information that isn't identifiable in some way. And one of the, there have been several studies, very prominent studies about de-identification, and they reveal some startling results, and results that make this debate very complicated. One is a study by LaTanya Sweeney, where she was able to identify a very high percentage of people with the following three pieces of data: gender, date of birth, and zip code. And that can identify quite a large percentage of individuals. So it really shows that you don't need a whole lot to, in fact, turn information and make it identifiable. And it's often different combinations of pieces that could, it's not just one piece that's identifiable, it could be combinations of pieces in different combinations. So that makes it complicated. Another study that was done was a study involving Netflix movie ratings. And Netflix, you might have heard, is a movie provider, and it's also, I think it's known as Quickster. Now it's, it's Netflix. It's not clear what it's, it's but Netflix released de-identified data about people's movie ratings. And researchers were able to take that information and identify something like 80% of the people who had rated three or more movies. How did they do this? What happened? Well, what they did was they found sources online where people had rated movies and revealed their identities. And then they matched that data to the data on the Netflix study, the de-identified Netflix data, and presto, they were able to figure out who the people were. And this really gets to one of the heart of, and the trick of the tricky part of de-identification, that it really depends on context. It depends on the data that's out there already, because the more data out there about a person that is identified, I have, you know, various things I wrote online, various information about me online where my name is attached. Now, if you throw out a set of data that is de-identified, but those same details appear in it, it becomes easier to identify that data. And so the Netflix study was able to link up the data because there existed a site called Internet Movie Database, or IMDb, where people rated movies and used their names. If IMDb didn't exist, the researchers likely would not have been able to achieve the result that they did. And this is, I kind of liken this to some extent to the problem of the kind of pollution outside the Earth with satellites. You know, there's all this satellite debris, and now it's becoming increasingly likely that if you go up there, there's a greater risk of a collision between some of this space junk. And to some extent, we're amassing this space junk around the Earth increasingly, and it's becoming a bigger and bigger risk as we have more shuttles and other kind of rockets sent out into outer space. Well, the same is happening with information. As more and more information gets out there about us, it becomes harder to release de-identified data because there's more likely going to be a collision or a match between those data, and that will then allow the identification of the information. And so we're dealing with a changing landscape, an evolving landscape of what could be identified and not identified. It's hard to say forever that with any kind of degree of, you know, that anything is identifiable or not identifiable for eternity, because things change as more information is added out there. And details can be matched up. And as technology changes also, it can change the ability to identify something or not identify something. And so we're really dealing with a target that's moving. And that creates problems because when we understand identification, it's really about risk. And there really isn't, there really aren't absolutes in this area. There are risks in this area. There's a risk of identification with a wide array of data that could be released. And so this is the world that we live in. And then that raises the question that some have raised, is PII even workable as a concept? If we can't pin it down, if it's so wriggly and technology is going to change it, is it worth having a concept of PII as the foundation of our law? And with that, I will turn it over to Paul and what we think we should do about this.
So to pick up from what Dan has just said, what we decided was that the best way to think about identifiability is that it is a continuum of risk. And so that's what our reading of the computer science led us to conclude. It's yet the law views it as I said, a single dichotomy, right? A hard on-off switch where either privacy law and all the fair informations apply or you get none of them. So we decided that best way to think of this is identifiability is a continuum of risk. And then our next conclusion was, going back to our role as law professors, that the best way for the law to proceed would be to start with a standard and not a rule. So remember, we started talking about the way the law currently views information privacy and the way statutes currently proceed, and we decided that the initial starting point should be a standard and not a rule. So to remind you of that very important, very traditional legal distinction, a standard is a broad-based decision tool. And it's the notion, for example, that you should, at a railroad crossing, proceed with reasonable caution. So open-ended. Drive at a reasonable speed. A rule is a harder-edged decision tool, and the example would be then stop, look, and listen at the railroad crossing. Or drive at 55 miles per hour. If you drove at 56 miles per hour, you were speeding. If you're driving at 54 miles, you were okay. So as an initial point, we think privacy law should not have this hard on-off switch, but a standard. And we do that because we think that in situations of rapid change, rules can quickly become obsolete. And that's the problem with the statutes that just list specific types of PII. We also think that if you have very heterogeneous behavior to be regulated, very different kinds of situations in which things can become PII, you're much better off with a standard, right? Because otherwise what you're going to need is a highly detailed codification. Every privacy law is going to look at like something like the Internal Revenue Code with then streams of regs that interpret it. And then finally, we think that there's going to be a back and forth between standards and rules, that you can start with the standard, but then there may be parts of the law and parts of technology that look relatively settled at a given point in time, and the legal system may be able to generate useful rules. So what our next point is then, we think that since identifiability is a continuum of a risk, it doesn't make sense to have the full range of fair information practices apply the minute you can say there is, right, as currently, you either have PII or you don't have PII. So we identify these three categories: identify information, identifiable, and non-identified. And our basic insight here is, or our basic argument here is, you tailor the fair information practices and you don't get them all if you're in this middle category, right? Because currently what the law says, PII and everything, or non-PII and nothing. And that doesn't really make sense for us, because for one thing, if you're in the identifiable category, information where there is some possibility that it might become identified information one day, but you're not there yet. When we go through the list of fair information practices, it doesn't really make sense to apply them all to identifiable information. Indeed, it might be counterproductive. And so a quick example is, if you give full notice, access, and correction rights to information simply because it's identifiable, right, on some theoretical level, the difficulty is, to give those notice, access, and correction rights, you have to make the information identified. That is, you have to trace it to a specific individual. And once you do that, you've actually increased the privacy risk, where we think you should provide incentives in the law for people who have information to have it in the least identifiable way possible and not force them to make it identified. Moreover, we're very worried if you apply the full range of FIPS for information practices to all identifiable information. Well, we're worried because then you could get limitations on information use, requirements of data minimization, and restrictions on information disclosure to all kinds of information that's not really identified, that's not likely to become identified, and that is extremely useful to society. And so in the paper, we have all kinds of examples of data analytics where it's doing great things for businesses, it's doing great things for the public, and you really don't want to come in and say, wait, data minimization, restrictions on use, simply because there's some theoretical possibility that it might become identified. So the idea is, in the paper, is tailor FIPS to risk, create incentives for companies to keep information in the least identifiable form possible. And then finally, we do think that contextual benchmarks for evaluating these categories of identified, identifiable, and non-identified can be created. And we look to work by, first of all, various kinds of computer scientists, such as Khaled El Aman. And we also look at some of the data security work, some of the work, indeed, of Microsoft researchers on the security development lifecycle, SDL. And it does look like there are useful benchmarks that are out there, so you can look at possible risk, and you can figure out what the chances of the identifiable information becoming identified. That there are benchmarks for figuring that out. Final point, and next to last slide, we criticize scholars such as Paul Ohm in the paper who say you should just do away with PII, that it's an irrelevant category. We do agree, though, with Paul Ohm as to the dangers of release and forget. And so release and forget is the notion that the data administrator, once it releases the records, can just, as a general matter, forget about anything that happens with the information. We are more in favor, when possible, of a track and audit approach as part of these risk assessments that we've sketched out in the paper. And so there should be, as a general matter, an obligation to track what happens to records after release. There should be increased use of metadata to help in this effort. And there should be risk assessment so that we can figure out when that identifiable information is likely to become identified and allow people to assess the levels of risk that follow. Okay, so last slide is simply to give you a little bit of the California sunshine here in Washington, D.C., and to thank you for your attention.
Start with brief reactions to the paper from the panel. Does this make sense? Does this continuum of risk from very identified data all the way down to non-identified data with this category in the middle, this interesting category of identifiable data? where you have a sliding scale of risk and different fits in this little category. Does this make sense? Initial reaction from the panel, starting from left to right.
I can start. First of all, I wanted to thank the professors for a great presentation and a really thoughtful paper. And I just like to make 3 points. First is, I think I agree with the problem, as stated in the paper, that the distinction between PII and non-PII no longer makes as much sense as it used to. We've talked at the FTC about the blurring of the distinction between PII and non-PII. We first talked about it in our 2009 report on behavioral advertising. I think it was somewhat controversial then, less so last year when we released our preliminary draft paper on consumer privacy. We held 3 roundtables and repeatedly panelists talked about the blurring of the distinction between PII and non-PII. So I think the identification of the problem is really right on point. Second, in terms of the sliding scale approach, I think there are benefits as well as drawbacks. I think the benefits are, as the professors have stated, that an all or nothing system really doesn't make sense. You have to scale the solution to the risk associated. And this is an approach that we've used in a lot of areas at the FTC, probably most notably in the data security area. We've said that the level of security that data should be provided should depend on the level of risk associated with that data. So you have to look at the types of data, you have to look at the uses of data, you have to look at the risks of harm, and the level of security for a particular type of data or a particular use of data should depend on that risk of harm. I think it's a very analogous approach that's proposed in the paper on PII and non-PII. Obviously, the drawback of that approach is that it provides less certainty for businesses. And it's something that we've heard a lot at the FTC on the data security side that, you know, there's no kind of bright line rule here. How is industry supposed to know what the right level of security is in the security example? And so the third thing I just wanted to mention is, I think as a supplement to the sliding scale approach, I just wanted to throw out 3 additional ideas of how to deal with this problem of the blurring of the distinction. The first is one that's mentioned in the paper. The professors talked about this idea of having statutes with specific definitions of PII. PII is name in combination with X, Y, and Z. The paper also talks about the idea of, if you have these statutes, you could have a provision that allows for agency rulemaking to change the definition of PII so that you're keeping up with technology a little bit more than you would in a bright line statutory regime. An example of this approach is in the COPPA, the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, which was passed in the late 90s, early 2000s. Back in September, we are reviewing the COPPA rule, and we are proposing to make some changes based on changes in technology. So for example, under the old COPPA rule, an IP address alone would not necessarily have been considered PII unless it was associated with a particular individual. In our COPPA rule review, we're proposing that the IP address itself, if it's used to track consumers or children over time, should be considered PII, and we're seeking comment on that issue. So that's potentially one way of dealing with the changing technology. A second idea is to increase accountability. And one way to do that is to ask companies to publicly commit that we will not re-identify data. We are collecting anonymous data. We will take no measures to re-identify it with particular individuals. And similar to the track and audit proposal mentioned in the paper, to the extent that the company is sharing information with third parties or service providers, maybe putting in contractual provisions saying that people that they share this anonymous information with will not re-identify the information either. And this is an approach that was outlined in the closing letter in our Netflix investigation. So the professors mentioned the Netflix issue where they released a reportedly anonymous data set that actually turned out could be reassociated with individuals. We investigated the company and we actually closed our investigation, and the closing letter basically points to Netflix commitments to not release publicly available data, to release data under contractual restrictions, not to re-identify individuals. So it's another idea. And a third idea is what we call in our privacy report the concept of privacy by design. And this is actually supplemented by our orders last year against Google and Facebook, which require both companies to maintain comprehensive privacy programs. And actually, the architect of our Google order is sitting in the audience, Katie Brin. But one of the provisions in the comprehensive privacy program, it's actually not tied to PII. It doesn't say that once there is PII, you must have a comprehensive privacy program for that PII. It says, for any information that you collect from or about consumers, you have to do a risk assessment as part of your privacy program. Could this be re-identified? What are the risks of this data? And then you scale your privacy program based on those risks. So I do think that the paper has many interesting ideas. I think the proposal has many benefits, keeps up with technology, and it addresses many of the problems that you identify. I think there may be some other ideas out there to supplement it in order to provide more guidance.
Well, I also enjoyed the paper. And I actually also enjoyed the idea, and some of you will be surprised to hear me say this, because you only see me as the privacy person at the ACLU, but we also understand that de-identified data has enormous value. I mean, I'm always discussing with our civil rights lobbyists how we need this data in the school context, for example, to make sure that students are receiving an appropriate educational level, not particularly identified students, but generally at the school level, to make sure that they, you know, are not, there's not inappropriate discipline for minority students. So there's really is a need to balance here. It's not just to suppress the data all the time. You know, one of the things that I thought was most interesting and useful was this idea that this particular regime would incentivize anonymity. In other words, you would be encouraging people not to be in a system where they were identifying particular individuals. And I think that's actually a crucial point. I mean, I hear repeatedly that, you know, we don't want to know who people are. We want to use this, whether it's behavioral targeting or in a variety of other contexts. We don't want to know who they are. We want to use the data without identifying. And to the extent that a legal regime can incentivize that, I think it's very valuable. I think it would really help to advance the debate. I will throw out another idea for how you might shape this standard. I don't think it's one that you'll particularly enjoy, but I think it makes some sense. I mean, when we're talking about a standard, typically we decide how a standard is going to be shaped through adjudication. And that's, you know, whether it's a common law doctrine, we typically have cases. And we bring them forward and they say, you know, you did what you're supposed to do here, you didn't do what you were supposed to do here. Now, that raises, you know, obviously significant issues. Businesses don't want to be guinea pigs for an adjudicatory process. We understand that, but by the same token, if they aren't doing what they should be doing, I think we also agree that there should be enforcement actions. So there's a balancing test there, but I do think that there has to be a role for a give and take that maybe goes beyond just the FTC, that goes to the state AGs. I mean, we would like to see it go to a private right of action where that's appropriate. But, you know, again, you're going to need something that's going to supplement a standard and give you some kind of, you know, additional impetus towards crafting what the actual contours of the standard are going to look like. Two more things. One, they also, there was a focus that on transparency and this idea that how information was collected should be transparent. That was one of the things that should go with not identified, but identifiable information. This idea of creating transparency so you know where information came from. We think that that's very valuable in terms of making sure that we understand where information is going, you know, who collected it, what they initially collected it for. So that transparency point is a very good one. And the final idea is kind of a quibble. I don't think that it's a binary question of identify somebody, you're going to automatically harm them. Not identify somebody, you're automatically not going to harm them. I mean, we see this in the insurance redlining context, for example. You can harm people using data without identifying them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the paper addresses this and sort of considers it maybe outside of the privacy realm and more of a discrimination or insurance question. I mean, I guess the ACLU, we don't consider ourselves bounded by any particular category. We'll go wherever we think that the problem is. So I'll say that I think you do have potential discrimination problems. You do have potential issues that come even if information isn't identified. And I think that you may not be able to address it here, but I think you at least need to be aware that we may not be solving that particular problem.
Well, I want to also thank the professors for some excellent work and Microsoft for the invitation to come here and speak. My practice focuses primarily on Federal Trade Commission, and while there are a host, and people complain about a host of disparate laws, I'm going to limit at least my initial comments to that aspect of privacy law, which is enforced by the FTC under Section 5 of the FTC Act. I think that the paper provides a nice framework to think about privacy, like Manisha, perhaps even more so than Manisha. My job is primarily advising companies on how to comply with privacy law. And there are the market abhors a vacuum, and the market abhors uncertainty, and the sliding scale with a middle tranche or middle bucket of data that could be identified and would be great for me. I could bill a lot of hours to that, but I think it's very, very difficult for businesses to make that determination and get it right and have it right forever after the decision has been made. And so I think, first of all, it's very difficult to apply this to business so that they have the certainty they need to go forward. One of the most common questions I get is, what's the rule and how do I comply? And this would be a difficult one to give advice on. I think also it would be quite difficult for the Federal Trade Commission to have any consistency in its enforcement of this paradigm, especially because it's a new paradigm. It would take a while to shake out in enforcement actions to give predictability to business that business needs. The second thing I want to raise is that the paper proceeds on a presumption, perhaps fair in many circumstances, that the law is too cumbersome and the legal process is too cumbersome to keep up, and so we need to take a step back and have a more generalized standard. At least with respect to the Federal Trade Commission, I disagree. I think the Federal Trade Commission actually has done quite a nice job of trying very hard to keep up with technology in a way that takes into account input from all the stakeholder groups. The FTC has a number of tools at its disposal that give people like me the information I need to properly advise clients on how to comply with what I call this emerging soft law area. And so the FTC can bring enforcement actions, and those orders, in case you didn't know, are intended to apply directly to the company and indirectly to industry as a signal of how the FTC intends to enforce Section 5. To that extent, it's not unlike a rule. It's not a rule, but it operates with the same notice to industry effect. The FTC also can issue rules, and that is a tedious process that involves a lot of jumping through regulatory hoops. But one thing the FTC also does, which is enormously helpful in my practice and I think to industry generally, is issue all kinds of guides on how to comply with the rules. One of the best documents the FTC has ever put out, I think, to business is how to maintain proper information security procedures. That's a guide. It doesn't require APA rulemaking. It's not necessarily self-enforcing, but it says, right now, in the world we live in, this is what we think you should be doing. And that can be updated quickly and easily by the FTC and gives great notice to business. I send that to most of my new clients. Here's a checklist, and it's going to grow and change over time. The final thing I want to say is that the paper focuses on a sliding scale on the theory that the farther you move along the scale, the more risk there will be and the more presumption there'll be that there should be regulation application of the FIPS. The FTC has a doctrine of similar nature called materiality. And in my view, anyway, the FTC's treatment of privacy law has begun to coalesce around its longstanding treatment in advertising law and in consumer protection law generally. If it's material in advertising law, you need to disclose it. If it's material in privacy law, you need to disclose it. And perhaps it's so material that you need to get some kind of consent. So my own view is that the market understands materiality, and the FTC understands materiality. So I'd prefer a standard in privacy that that goes along that continuum. The more likely it is that there'll be harm, the more likely it is a consumer would, the way to say this, is the more likely it is a consumer would view a collection, use, disclosure, processing of data to be material. That is to affect whether the consumer wants to participate, provide this information, go to this website, do whatever, the more protections should apply to it. And that's a standard we all understand. And finally, I want to say that Manisha's comments don't necessarily reflect the opinion of the commission or any individual commissioners, and mine don't reflect the views of any of my clients. These are my own views, but I think they're right.
I think that the one I might quibble with is the use limitation, because if you have data that could be identifiable and you don't put any use limitations out there, you put it out publicly, I mean, this is exactly what happened in the Netflix situation. And so this is a question for the professors. I think later in the paper you talk about the need for track and audit. Wouldn't that equally apply to identifiable data? Is that potentially inconsistent with not applying use limitations?
Yeah, let me respond to a few points that were made. Go to Chris, and then we'll get to track and audit, and also Reed's comments, just as a kind of quick cut through those excellent responses. For Chris's comment about how, you know, the problems of redlining and some other civil liberties issues, in the paper we talk about how think these are very important issues, and we're sympathetic to them, but we don't think they are necessarily best handled as privacy issues. And that came out in part because of our work with the Public Health Institute in Oakland, California. And as you saw in the paper, there's a whole discussion of the problem of childhood obesity and marketing to children. And in part, these are problems of information privacy to the extent that food companies have what's essentially identified information about children, and they're targeting specific children. A lot of the other issues associated with childhood obesity, as sympathetic as Dan and I are to them, and working with the Public Health Institute has been wonderful and really very stimulating. We've learned a lot. But a lot of them at the end of the day really sound in things like advertising and issues about kind of just how we have marketers communicate with our children. And we finally decided, as much as we love privacy law, we don't think everything is an information privacy issue, and that we will kind of shortchange the really core privacy issues if we expand out our field too much. So that's my response to Chris. Regarding to Reed's wonderful comments about the middle bucket, I think that he's really, that to a large extent, you're dealing with even greater uncertainty. Well, actually, first comment is we're glad if we get you more billable hours. So even though I'm sure you have more than enough, but anything to help the cause. And then the second thing I would say is actually, you know, in thinking about your comments, and you know kind of your landscape better than we do, but it also seemed that you're really dealing with as much or more uncertainty if broke it down and dealing kind of with the way the FTC proceeds and really relatively general decisions in cases like Google, in cases like Netflix, and then you figure out how to operationalize it for your specific industry. And so we're really just providing, I think in many ways, a variation of that, although perhaps dressed up in law professor language, in saying that we also need to think about the PII category in this term, and then just to provide a little extra clarity, then to say in this middle bucket, let's at least have a general sorting function so that if something really is, and we do think that there are some things at the end of the day that are non-identifiable, and we should just put them in the category, right, unless something changes dramatically with technology, as it did for Dick Tracy, and we're just going to call it non-identified, and we're not going to apply the PII. And then we do think that there are benefits to saying, let's think about this middle category, where, and then in the paper there's a nuance, because we say there's really stuff that's you may call it identifiable, but at the end of the day, there's such a significant probability that it's going to be identified that we move it into that category, right? Because otherwise it gets pretextual, that you're just calling it identifiable and it's really identified. But we actually do think that the middle category, we may be wrong, and you probably know, you know, what your landscape looks like on a daily basis than we do, but that there would be sufficient clarity in telling clients, keep doing the risk assessment the same way you do it for data security. At the end of the day, these categories will at least help you and will get you fewer FIPS as long as you can make a good case that it's just identifiable and not identified. So, yeah. So that's our hope. And actually, Dan probably wants to jump in.
I'd like to jump in there, because I do think some of the things that you talked about that you liked about what the FTC has done are standard-like, in that they're not rigid, they're not fixed. And the thing that we most want to avoid is a hardwired piece of legislation that defines these things, because that's the hardest thing to change. A rule that would delegate, or the FTC would issue a rule and say, okay, here are the things that are come up with a specific list, but that the FTC could regularly change, would be better. And we think that, you know, obviously, it would depend on how rapidly that change would keep up with technology and how frequently that would be updated. So that, in a way, would be a kind of a compromise position. It wouldn't be as hardwired as a legislative rule. It wouldn't be as nimble as our approach, but it could be, I think, consistent with our approach if done the right way. And that could provide some degree of certainty. But there is still always going to be a large degree of uncertainty in the law. It's going to be the case, there's going to be areas of gray that are going to get filled in over time as industry best practices arise, as people study things and learn things and develop things. The hope is that we will get a gradual consensus, just like data security. There aren't often bright line rules there, but over time we get a sense of what works and what doesn't work. We get standards, and I think we have a clear picture at least of what you must do, what you shouldn't do. But there are going to be those gray areas as technology evolves. But I don't think you can totally clear them, and I think if you want to be too clear, press too much for bright line rules, I think that could be a problem, because those bright line rules are going to fail. It's ultimately just that balance. It's great to provide right line guidance, but at the same time, we need nuanced rules because we're in such a dynamic field. And ultimately, of course, we don't want a rule that's so mushy that no one knows what to do, and therefore everyone's afraid or not certain about the landscape. And so we hope that, you know, there's a lot of approaches that could provide the next balance, you know, certainty and flexibility.
And let me just quickly respond to your comment, which I said I'd get back to, which is the track and audit requirement and identifiable data. I guess I have to think a little bit about that. But the main thing is, for identifiable data, definitely ongoing risk assessment. And then in many instances, a track and audit approach will make sense of that. And then the final quick thing is, so one of the things also that's driving our paper and that we are very excited about is analytics. And just, you know, big data. Big data's here. It's going to continue to be important. It's going to be driving things like healthcare research in the 21st century. It's going to be driving a lot of what business can do to be more efficient. You see this in the Wall Street Journal, other newspapers dealing with the business community, that companies that can actually drill down into all the data that businesses have are hot right now. And so with all the things that are happening for analytics and big data, we view privacy law, if it gets too rigid in saying everything's PII and throwing that switch on, as just being unrealistic. And then what we're also worried about is that at the same time, if it throws the big switch and says it's off, it becomes meaningless. And so we're trying to kind of hit that middle ground for the future of analytics.
I'm curious, I heard you major in that. Is there a reason to sort of say, let's have a useful limitation
that's identifiable information that's simply we the collector are bringing that to try to identify the person. In other words, we're collecting identifiable but not identified information. We presume we don't need to identify the person because we gave you collecting identified. So I mean, see, that would be a very tough conversation because then at least the initial collector and hopefully the people they shared would have that use limitation baked in, saying, well, you guys have got this, but you know, if you're going to be a good actor, you can't identify people. And I think that would give another sort of right of mind rule and give sort of more per se guidance for both business and for the FEC.
Yeah, so I'll actually be worried about that, and just giving you, this is why I'd probably be a bad presidential candidate, you know, like, but he wouldn't say yes or no. But I've done some work on a National Science Foundation committee with Professor Fred Cade of the University of Indiana, cybersecurity, and we're looking at healthcare research. And so, you know, in the past, the way healthcare research was carried out was you gave one group the placebo, you gave the other group the drug, and you followed them, and you saw what happened. The future of healthcare research is drilling down to really big data sets, and in many instances, you don't know what you're going to be looking for before you start doing the research. And second of all, the permutations of when you might want to identify the person to follow up, ask follow-up questions, become extremely complex. And so I would be loath to say, even though I'm an agreeable person, I'd want to agree with you, but I'd be loath to say, just as a formal matter, yes, let's go with that use limitations for identifiable information, because I think that could really be problematic in the health research area.
This is why the Federal Trade Commission Act, originally promulgated in 1914 and that was substantially updated in 38 and 94, continues to live and breathe as a generalized approach. I am also an agreeable person, but I'm loath to adopt the blind application of the PIPs or any one of them to a fact that somebody became identifiable. To me, the right approach for the law to take is to tie the rule to what a consumer's reasonable expectations are and what the potential harm could be if the data becomes identifiable. And that's been the FTC's approach, and that's an approach you can explain to a client. Look, this became identifiable. Would your mother be surprised? Would you be embarrassed to tell your mother that you did this? Would you yourself want to interact with the company in this way if you knew this? And so I think the better application of the law for something that can actually be complied with and do a social good without unduly interrupting legitimate business functions is to tie the bits or parts of them to the actual part of what you're doing that would be material to a consumer and to the potential harm that could arise to the consumer. And that's what the FTC has done. That's what business is used to trying to comply with, and the FTC is doing more of it with the forthcoming privacy report, and they have done more of it. The paper begins with the FTC can only bring a law of civil action against a company who makes a privacy representation that turns out to be false. But the deception standard also applies to a material omission, and there are a number of FTC cases now saying, yeah, well, what you said, we don't take issue with, although sometimes they do. But what you didn't say is what we really have a problem with. And so that'd be my point, is more carefully tailoring the remedy to the harm and to the materiality rather than picking sets of data and applying certain FIPs to them across the board.
I think as this discussion is emerging, I think one of the challenges of saying, okay, here are the three categories, and here are the FIPs that apply, and here are the FIPs that don't apply, they feel like we're running the same trap that we did when we defined PII versus non-PII. It's not an on-off switch that you can flip. It's not kind of an all or nothing, you're in, you're out. And I realize that doesn't provide as much certainty, but if you look at our preliminary report, we use terms like scalable, proportional, reasonable, material.
Commonly accepted.
Commonly accepted. So, you know, in a way, these are not hard and fast rules, and I think it just echoes the discussion we've been having, that it's not all or nothing, on or off. And I think that applies to which FIPS apply to which category as well.
So I think that what we want to do is kind of have a sensible understanding of harm, but also understand that harm's going to emerge in the future with information. Once information gets out there and is used in a certain way, a harm might materialize down the road, and we still might want to provide some protections and some limitations to prevent future harms from potentially happening and unexpected uses in the future. So I'm not sort of, I don't think harm should be so front and center. I don't think it should be irrelevant either. And so I just think it's important to note in terms of the kind of logistical issues, you know, sort of how to who decides this? You know, that's a very good question. One is to have certainly agency involvement in that process. It could be that we have. Could be even a safe harbor system where certain standards are defined and then revised, and then there's a safe harbor there. There could be a system where companies come up with the best standard, and then if it isn't good, if it doesn't work, then there's a check on that, where if their standard isn't good, then it gets challenged and possibly overridden. I think the best approach is one that draws input from the various stakeholders. I think that I don't like the idea of sort of putting our eggs in one basket and allowing just industry to make this decision, or just the agency. I think it's a collective decision that a lot of people need to collaborate to make. And I think that our approach tries to allow that to happen. Specifically, in the nitty-gritty, we haven't really drilled down that far about precisely how to get defined. Just that the project of doing so is very important. And there are different models and different ways that this type of thing gets done in other contexts.
The way the project came about is Dan and I have this statutory compilation, all the privacy laws in the U.S., or many of them, and I read them through, and I put tabs on the laws wherever it said definition of PII, definition of personal information. So then at the end of the day, in this 1,000-page paperback, I had all these yellow tabs. And then I read what they said, and they were all over the map, as Dan pointed out in that slide. And so really all we're trying to do in this paper is to say, for all those laws, whether or regulations with the FTC, when you think about PII, first of all, we're going to give you a typology of the way that this has been thought about in the past. And to our amazement, there's no standard definition. And I think that's very problematic, because you've got this on and off switch, and it depends very much on the kind of patchwork of laws we have, where if you fall under the Cable Act, because of this the way your industry is traditionally defined, you have one definition of PII. And then if you fall under GLB, they just decide to slap in another definition of PII. So one problem that I think we very successfully identify is nobody has thought about this systematically as to how the law is defining PII across these different statutes and regulations. So one thing we would say in terms of process is that's going to depend on the way the process is done for the Child's Online Privacy Protection Act, for the GLB Act, and so on and so forth. But we think this is the way you should think about PII across the board. And I think Reid, in terms of your issue about uncertainty, that's going to reduce a lot of uncertainty, because right now you're hopefully going through our statutory compilation, or maybe you have another one, and you're going, oh, wait, I have to now tell this client in a slightly different industry that his underlying definition of PII is different when they're doing stuff that looks like it's cable as opposed to stuff that looks like GLB. So then I think the process plays out depending on the given context as defined by the statutes and regulations. We managed to have a comparative focus in the paper as well. And so we identify an expansionist reading of PII outside of the US. And I think particularly for analytics, we've heard the accountability term being used, which I think is a very important concept, and that we, I think, are more receptive to generally in the U.S. than outside. So we think it's very much a useful idea for the rest of the world, because we do see the European Union as being extremely expansionist in the notion of what is and what is not PII, and basically saying, you know, if something's identifiable, you should, as a starting matter, apply all the fair information practices to it. And then when you talk to European regulatory officials about it, what they say is, well, yes, we want the full data protection FIPS to apply to identifiable data, but don't worry about it, because we, as the regulators, will then figure out what's appropriate. But then it's the kind of threshold matter. They want to be able to have kind of full jurisdiction. And I think if you then talk to American businesses and international businesses, they're a little bit worried about that as a starting point, that everything's going to be all identifiable data gets treated as identified, and then you have to go through a frequently cumbersome process to figure out exactly what you can and cannot do.
I'll push back a little, or I'll push a little further than that, you know, radical that I am, and say again that consumers should have a more direct involvement. If we have a harm, there should be a remedy for that harm, and that should be a direct consumer, a consumer being able to exert a remedy. You know, and that's in some ways the best way a consumer can be involved, is when they have a discrete harm. They can, you know, put it forward, and then that can become part of identifying the standard going forward and identifying what the parameters of the standard are. I just think that kind of consumers not being represented in the abstract, but concretely when they have harms.
I'm Baron Soga from Tech Creative. I'm really looking forward to reading your paper. This is really quite refreshing to hear such a balanced discussion that recognizes the benefits of data. It sounds like your approach really is quite groundbreaking in that regard. And in particular, Paul, I'm really curious, you hit the nail on the head when you described the European approach as saying that the DPAs want the full FIPS to apply on paper, but basically fudge in practice how they actually apply it. And it seems like you're really, as I say, hitting the nail on the head there in responding to Reed's concern about the rule of law, which is how do companies and innovators predict what the outcome is going to be. So I'm curious to hear you elaborate on that comment. I mean, how do you see the system you're proposing becoming predictable for innovators who are in particular developing new and perhaps unexpected uses of data that maybe has already been collected in the past? How do you see them being build innovative services under the framework you develop, and be able to go to their investors and say, you know, we're reasonably confident that this is going to work here because, you know, we have a predictable track record of dealing with the agency that has this standard. So in other words, it seems like your goal is to come up with not a clear bright line rule, but a predictable standard. So how do you make that workable in a way that the European system, I think, as you rightly point out, really isn't?
This is tough, and I understand exactly what you say about, in a way, having to operationalize things, not only for lawyers, but also so venture capitalists can assess, you know, if I'm putting the money on this number, you know, my chips on this one, how do I assess the risk here as opposed to other areas? And it's really difficult because of the rate of change of technology. And so it is going to continue to be hard to boil down. The kind of clearest example that we could see, which unfortunately is not super clear maybe for your purposes, is with data security, right? With where we have information, and we've had maybe, I guess, almost 10 years now of experience with data security laws. It's not super comforting because we do, at the end of the day, have standards like, has there been access to the information? Very difficult sometimes to figure out, right? And then looking at the type of information and figuring out the kinds of harm. So I guess then my response to you is the discussion with the VCs is going to tell you're going to have to tell them or her that based on kind of this looking at the kind of risk continuum, right? And our assessment of how, you know, what harms can result, we think that we have reasonable processes in place moving forward so that, and then, you know, we can use this, do this kind of innovative approach. And at the end of the day, again, it's just going to be looking at this kind of risk continuum and evaluating it on an ongoing basis in terms of that. Not much different, you know, than if you think about environmental risks to the environment and technology in that context. So it is, at the end of the day, unfortunately, you know, a lot of uncertainty, a lot of risks out there. And so it's not necessarily going to be an easy conversation, but hopefully it's going to be a better conversation than saying that because this information does have identifiable elements, you're going to have to deal with all of European data protection law and all of privacy law and the full and going country to country and trying to get permission to do this and register with regulatory regimes.
On the question of PII, I mean, I think I don't know exactly how we're going to end up. The commission has to weigh all the comments that were received, but I can tell you a little bit about the comments that we got. So in the preliminary report, we said that the framework that we're proposing, the baseline principles, wouldn't apply if data could not be reasonably linked to the consumer computer or device. And I think the main comment that we got in response, well, two main comments. One is the kind of lack of certainty and predictability that we've been talking about. The other main comment was that there's a concern that almost all data is re-identifiable, and so maybe you're not creating the adequate incentives for companies to at least try to anonymize data and strip data of identifiers so that they are taking steps to anonymize data. So I think that we will try to provide some guidance and clarification to address those points. I can't wait to see where we'll end up, but those are the types of issues we're considering.
So we're out of time, so that's the last question. And I want to thank all Dan, Misha, Chris, and Reedy for their time.